We all owe them, but very few of us know them. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities. And these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Whether you're a rancher needing to deal with varmints or a professional who has to shoot regularly to remain qualified, you may have thought about adding a silencer to your rifle or pistol. Check out the great products from our friends at SilencerCentral.com. Silencers are legal in 41 states, and the folks at Silencer Central are the experts. Begin your journey at SilencerCentral.com. They'll handle all the paperwork and ship your silencer right to your front door once you're approved. That's SilencerCentral.com. A good friend of mine, John Esslinger, who has now flown west, God rest his soul, tried to join the Air Force during the Vietnam era, but they wouldn't have him. Nonetheless, he did two tours of duty in Vietnam. He never shared much information about those days other than a strong insinuation that his paycheck came from an organization that goes by three initials. He really struggled on Veterans Day. I tried to convince him that he shared the same mud and blood as those in uniform, and he had nothing to be ashamed of. I don't know if my perspective ever really took hold. His entire life was dedicated to airplanes. I accepted today's guest request from his publisher to honor John, because he's a cat of the same stripe. After a short 4-year stint in the Air Force, at age 23, he was hired as the pilot for Teamsters boss Jimmy Hoffa. Soon thereafter, his paychecks came from an organization with three initials. And that's just the beginning of his tale. His life story is recounted in the book Flight, an Air America's Pilot's Story of Adventure, Descent, and Redemption. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Captain Neil Graham Hansen.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate that.
Boy, Neil, you got a great voice. You ever considered a career in radio?
Oh, I did that a long time ago, back in the 50s. Radio K1, the right one, 1450 on your radio dial, Reno, Nevada.
I tell you what, after this show, I'm going to ask you to do some taglines for me, and we'll see if we can work out a deal. Now, Neil, the rumor has it, well, let's just say the movie Air America, there is too many coincidental locations and events. Is any of that film based on your life story?
Vaguely. John Eskow, the screenwriter, and I worked on that movie, but of course I don't have the features of Mel Gibson or the abilities to be on camera. But everything was pretty close. He used some of the skits of mine that I used to harass co-pilots with, and it was a Hollywood movie. It wasn't real life, nor was it a documentary, but it did get the name out there, and that was the main purpose of it. Some guys didn't like it because they weren't in the movie, but Mel Gibson and Robert Downey Jr. got paid $8 million, and they're not going to pay some regular throttle bender that kind of money.
So was there one particular character that was you, or was it sort of a spread out over the different characters?
Mel Gibson was pretty much the one that John Eskow tried to put my stuff into, and some of the quirks I had, too.
Now, it's really apparent from, and I really enjoyed the book, by the way. You communicate the story very well with a lot of passion's not the right word, but, I mean, it's compelling, I'll put it that way. It's really apparent from reading the book, Neil, that you have been a adrenaline junkie pretty much your whole life. When did your love of flight begin, though?
Back when I was a preteen, I started building the solid balsa wood models that you used to carve out, and gas-powered airplanes and all of that sort of thing until my mother remarried. We moved to Detroit, and I'd take my bicycle and pedal out to Detroit City Airport and hang out there and bum rides, which you could do back in those days, and washed airplanes, and that fueled my money need to get flying lessons, and I started at 15. I had my commercial pilot's license before I graduated from high school, with all of that sort of thing going on.
That's pretty impressive. Now, my understanding is you also bought your own plane around that period in time, a Cessna 140 for a grand total of $1,300 American.
Yes, the same airplane today is in the $100,000 category. Insurance for me at 17 years old was only $26 a year. Boy, that won't even get you enough insurance to open the door.
I can't even get a subscription to Netflix to watch Air America for $26 a month. So, Neil, your part of your story is you were the pilot for Teamsters boss Jimmy Hoffa. What was he like?
He was a workaholic, and he was trying to run a million-man union all by himself. And, of course, there's all kinds of snakes in the grass hanging out waiting for him to stumble. And when he did, he went on a federal vacation for a few years. And at that point, I knew I was going to have to find another job, because most corporate jobs where you're privy to the boss's travels and contacts, they let you go, too. So I applied in Washington, D.C. to Air America, and it went onward and upward from that point.
What kind of plane did the Teamsters fly?
We had a Lockheed Lodestar, and we had about Conrad Beechcraft 9800. Both good airplanes and well-maintained. Of course, they could afford to maintain these things well. But we would not be on a regular flight schedule.
Now, Neil, you said that you knew that, you know, Jimmy was probably going to jail or a federal vacation, as you call this, so you started looking around for a job. There was a newspaper ad, of all things, saying we were looking for pilots for Southeast Asia, and so you called them up. They sent you a pretty vanilla application, I guess.
Right.
I mean, to me, one of the most interesting parts of the story that actually fits in with all of this, you contacted them, and they said, no, apparently the guy you talked to was very brusque, say, no, we're not hiring, you know, get lost. And then you were in another airport, was it Boston?
No, Chicago Lakefront, which is now gone. But, yes, I got a call to the airport manager's office, and it was Mr. Dawson on the line. And he was very pleasant and said, Captain Hansen, I've got a couple questions for you. And he says, can you fly good? And I was tempted to say, oh, no, the wreckage is still burning, but I didn't. And his next question was, do you drink a lot? And I thought maybe that is a requirement. But I said, no, sir. And he says, can you go in 10 days? And I told him, no, I'd like to give my employer proper notice. And when will I know if I'm hired? And he says, oh, you're hired. That's why I called. It was really kind of a confusing acceptance of a job.
So your radar didn't go up at all when, in effect, you had a two-question interview?
No, it did somewhat, yes. And, of course, he had me go back to Detroit. Well, I went back to Detroit that day, and he wanted me to send him a passport. So I went down to the passport office and filled out all their stuff and gave them the pictures. And I said, when will I get my passport? And he said, oh, it'll be 30 to 45 days. And I said, well, I'm going to go overseas here in about 10, 15 days. And they said, who are you going to work for? And I said, Air America. Well, I had the passport in 4 days. So it's kind of told me something funny going on in the back room.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
and on one of the last trips with one of the Teamster Union lawyers, he came up to the cockpit while my co-pilot was serving drinks. And he asked, you know, here you're leaving. I said, yeah. I says, where are you going? I says, Air America. And he laughed, and he says, oh, yeah, that's the CIA. And of course, you get great visions of Terry and a pirate stuff and back in those days, and the new James Bond novels that were coming out. But the reality is far from that glorified scenario.
Well, I tell you what, Neil, we're going to talk more about that reality when we come back after the break. Truly a fascinating story. And when we come back, I want to start off with two of my favorite words in the English language, plausible deniability. That certainly was a part of your daily life there. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Captain Neil Graham Hansen. He spent a number of years flying for Air America and Southeast Asia and some other adventures as well. Stick around. You're not going to want to miss it. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Captain Neil Graham Hansen. He spent a number of years flying for Air America. His story is told in the movie Flight, an Air America's pilot's story of adventure, descent, and redemption. Neil, just north of my current hometown, there's a big wide airstrip and several hangars, and it used to be owned by a company called Evergreen Air. And it was one of the worst kept secrets in the area as far as what they were actually doing out there. Was Air America at the time, I mean, was it pretty secret, unknown stateside, but over there in the places where you're flying, it was probably the world's worst kept secret?
They were trying to keep it secret from the American public. Now, I just really disagree with that totally. Why should we keep secrets from the people that are paying our bills? And they didn't want the American public to know what we were doing. The bad guys, of course, knew what we were. That was obvious. But they didn't trust the American public, I guess. And I still think they don't to this day.
I agree with that. Now, as I understand, at the time, Air America was quite a diverse and quite a large venture. I saw an interview where you said that Air America was almost as large as Pan American Airlines.
That's correct. The only thing was we did not have American registered airplanes. Most of our airplanes were Chinese registry or Lao registry. So that gave them plausible deniability if one of these airplanes was found somewhere it wasn't supposed to be. And of course, didn't give you a warm, tingly feeling when you took off.
What about you? What about the personnel? If you were captured, thank you so much, bye-bye, or was there some kind of a safety net?
No, there was no safety net. We did not have the backup of the military, like, you know, barracks and things like that, and guards, and that we had to live with the locals and the local economy. And all our medical personnel were Chinese, and we had Chinese licenses in that respect. I hold an airline transport rating in China, Laos, Cambodia, and a senior commercial down in New Zealand.
Now, did these countries have to check you out, or they just took your word for it, and they took, because it was Air America, they kind of looked the other way?
The Chinese didn't. The Chinese ground school was very entailed, and they dealt an awful lot into Chinese history, which, hey, it's their country, their license, so you better learn it. Some of the guys would poo-poo that, but I didn't. And I took it to heart, and I ended up passing the written test for an airline transport rating, and the first time that had been passed in 18 months.
Wow.
And, you're in their country, so you better not be poo-pooing them.
Yeah, Neil, part of your role there with Air America was to check out the other pilots, and what I took from your book is kind of a motley crew of some of these guys they would send you, but you had you mentioned that this about in the movie Air America, where all those scenes showed up. You had a penchant for playing tricks on some of those pilots, like the coloring book story. Tell us about that.
Yes, for new guys, they didn't know where they were. And the coloring book thing was a reality. I carry one in my flight kit, and after we get off the ground and down to hold a sitting, and I'd pull out a coloring book and start coloring. And if that didn't crumble their cookie, I didn't know what else would.
What was the washout rate? Because, again, from your book, Neil, some of these guys just were, I mean, I don't even know how. I guess maybe Air America really desperately needed pilots.
Yes, they were at a pension to get ex-military guys. I found the civilian-trained people much better and more flexible. And the military guys, they expected somebody to refuel the airplane, check the oil, and all the rest of that. No, we're out in the field. We do not have that infrastructure. You're going to do it yourself. You're going to get dirty. You're not going to have fun on a turnaround up country. You're going to have to haul a 5-gallon jerry can full of oil out there to put oil in the engine. C-46s, you normally used about a gallon an hour of oil. So you had a 36-gallon oil tank on those things.
As I understand, I may get this number wrong, but maybe 243 Air America personnel lost their lives while flying with you over there, which is a small number, but I would say relative to the number of pilots and crew you had is a very large number, and it wasn't just the Golden BB that was coming up and biting you. I mean, you know, bad runways, mountainsides, there's lots of things over there that get you killed.
That's right, and weather is another thing. We did not have fancy nav aids that tell you where you were, no GPS or anything like that. We had strictly a geometry problem, time and distance, and that kept you out of the cumulogranites, as we call the mountains.
Now, when we come back, I want to talk about your particular experience, Neil, with your crash, and it wasn't just one, but it was just kind of a bad day for you all around there. Let's talk. I want to share some things with what were you transporting on most of these flights? Was it anything from? I mean, were you flying pigs? Were you flying rice? Were you flying bombs? All of the above?
All of the above, yes.
And did it matter what kind of aircraft they would use? I guess it would have to depend on the weight of the cargo, yeah?
Somewhat. C-46s were mainly the rice drop airplane. The 123s that I flew in Laos were primarily munitions.
And you were flying these munitions to whom? Or you are not allowed to talk about that?
Oh, yes, to the Hmong people there. The Hmong were the indigenous hill tribes there, and they were loyal to a fault. And he was sad when we pulled out and left them twisting in the wind, and he was really very unhappy with that.
Yeah, I can imagine. So as you mentioned before, you lived amongst the locals, you spent your time with them, you ate their food, which in and of itself was an adventure. Do you have the sense, Neil, that allowed you and your fellow Air America people to get to know the folks that we're supposed to be supporting over there better than your average military?
Yes. I immersed myself into the culture. Some did not. They still wanted to cook American food and things like that, but I didn't care. I'd grown up in a rural farming area in northern Michigan. We ate whatever we caught on the trap line, or we smoked and canned and the rest of that. So none of this food was alien to me.
And money wasn't a problem. You had plenty of it, but you tell a funny story in the book about Ahmed the money changer. We've got just about a minute left. Walk us through how that process worked real quick, Neil.
That was in Saigon, and the official rate was very low as far as exchanging money for piastres in Vietnam. But Ahmed had a way of getting around that, and you'd take a check to him, and after the check cleared, he'd come back with triple what the exchange rate was. And the same thing with when they came in with military payment certificates, which was another golden opportunity to start larceny.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking about Neil Graham Hansen, who spent some time flying for Air America and Asia. If you're not familiar with the phrase, the Golden BB, we're going to introduce that to you. Neil had his own Golden BB situation. He's going to tell us that story when we come back. Don't forget, you can find this podcast and hundreds of others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Shooting with a silencer is not only better for your hearing, but can also be more fun as well. At Silencer Central, they have been making silence simple since 2005. Visit silencercentral.com to determine if owning a silencer is legal in your state. Choose from their wide selection of both rifle and pistol silencers and begin the paperwork. They provide interest-free financing while your paperwork is being processed. They can even thread your barrel if you need it. That's silencercentral.com. We're back talking with Neil Graham Hansen. Neil flew for Air America in Southeast Asia for a number of years. And Neil, if I get this correct, the Golden BB is something that the pilots and crew would talk about for the, you know, the one you don't see, but they get you and get you shot down. You had a misadventure of your own where your aircraft got hit. You ordered the crew to bail out. Your co-pilot was somewhat of a problem there. Describe to us what happened with that.
Yeah, this was down out of Pak Sei. We were airdropping to fire bases that were harassing the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And these were hot areas, as you might say. There'd been one of our caribou shot down there and lost the whole crew. But I had a different way of approaching these hot drop zones, and that was get it right down in the dirt. When you get up close, pull up, drop, and get the hell out of Dodge. But in this case, I was doing the same thing. Our helicopters, Air America helicopters, had been in and out of the site and hadn't taken any rounds. Well, I did the down low and had to throw smoke grenades out where they wanted to load dropped and them with high explosives. And as I got within about a half a mile of their site, I pulled up, and that's when they nailed me. And you could hear the rounds hit. There's a quick bang, you know, and immediately lost my ailerons, which are the things that make the airplane bank, and it started to roll into the jungle to the left. So I pulled the power off the right side and had full right rudder in, and she slowly came back, shaking like hell, and we staggered out of there, and a co-pilot was frozen. He'd been an Air Force colonel, and he got his colonel bird things due to the fact that he had a PhD in entomology, which is bug science, which I didn't think was very useful over there. But climbed up out of there, and it was shaking like hell, and I could tell that wasn't going to be able to make it back to Pak Sei. We're going to have to either put in the dirt or to go for a walk outside. And there was an old Japanese strip about 10 miles away, and I headed for that. And knew the lost control, and now I saw I was losing the fuel on the right side. They put a big hole in the nacelle tank, 700-gallon tank, and it was streaming fuel. And I told the guys, we're going to bail out here on this old Japanese strip, which is a fairly clear area, and supposedly was not unfriendly. And got the co-pilot and the loadmasters to come back. I had two Thai loadmasters, Sampop and Boma. And when I lined up and about to ring the bell for them to go, the co-pilot came back into the cockpit, and he wanted his camera. Well, okay. He went down the ladder into the cabin and about ready to ring the bell again, and he was back in the cockpit. He wanted his survival vest. Well, if you put that thing on, your parachute won't open. He went back down there, and I told the loadmaster, he's taken away from him, throw it out the door. The next time, I don't care what you do, get him out of here, because I'm having trouble up here. And the next go-around, Sam Pops was behind him, and Boomer, the other tie kicker, he went. And when Bill approached the door to see what had happened, Sam Pop took him out. It wasn't time enough for me to go at that time. I made another circuit around, and they called three good shoots. And I said, yeah, I'll be there. I'll keep your meter running. And Air America 34.
And unlike the movie where the pilot took it in for a belly landing, you had to get out, and that bird just augured in.
That's correct. Yeah, there was very little of it left.
So how long were you all on the ground before the first, I'll use the phrase, attempted rescue bird came in?
First one was, I was on the ground for about 3 minutes or so. I shut the harness and started for a little clearing that I knew that he'd try to pick me up in. And when he tried, he damaged his tail rotor in the trees and picked back up, and I rode the sling up into the cabin. From there, we went over to the strip, and he damaged his tail rotor, so we landed there and shut down. And another chopper came in, Air America chopper. Now, he'd had wounded on board, so we helped the wounded over there. But he landed about 100 meters away and, you know, got over there and, why'd you do that? And he says, well, you guys are in a minefield. So it couldn't have been very good mines. But he took off and had to wait for another helicopter to come in. And I had an Uzi salvaged from the other H-34. And when he landed and got in that thing and made an obscene gesture towards the bad guys at the cabin door, and he got to the edge of this Plateau de Bolivar, which is a high mesa, and he ran out of gas. And we auto-rotated down there in a little village. Didn't know if it was good guys or bad guys, but there was kids and dogs out around the huts. So that was a good sign. But as we rounded out, one of our H-34s that had the turbine modification came out of Cambodia, and he had gun mounts on it, and that gave me my last ride.
So by my count, 1, 2, 3, 4 aircraft.
That's right.
That's a heck of a day, Neil.
Yeah, it was bad. You can't drink enough then.
Tell us, you mentioned your kickers. Describe to us, I would use the term loadmaster, but your kickers were mostly, you know, Filipino or Thai, or you didn't have a lot of U.S. kickers?
We had some U.S. kickers. Gene Hassenfuss was one of them. But I liked the way the Thais conducted themselves, and they would follow instructions to the letter. And I felt a lot more secure with them.
The other thing I found interesting about your story is there was a point in time where the bad guys were introduced to SAM-7 missiles, and those made your job a lot less pleasant.
That's right. It was just a new Dragon in town, and they nailed one of our airplanes, one of the 123s up near Nakhon Phanom, and it was getting iffy. But the end was approaching. Kissinger was in the middle of these peace talks, which I kind of felt he gave everything away. But by that time, the loss of our airplanes, you got one crew that's still MIA. 123s, we lost over 50% of our guys, which that hurts.
Sure. And was there, did you have sort of a fatalistic attitude about it, Neil, or?
Not fatalistic. I was just addicted to the game. That was the bad part. The adrenaline was my drug of choice. You know, people want to do heroin and the rest of that sort of stuff, but no, give me the adrenaline. That makes my world better. You don't move any faster, but your brain works so much faster. It can do 10,000 things in a millisecond, and you can weigh the odds of what you're going to do. And that, to me, was great. Some people, they poop their pants, but that isn't going to get you out of the problem.
And that pilot that seized up on you, your co-pilot, did he ever fly again?
No, that was the end of his career.
And so, with Air America, when your career was over, they didn't just reassign you somewhere else. You were gone. You were back stateside.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Well, he actually stayed and went to work for a British outfit selling airline tickets in Vincennes.
Okay. I tell you what, when we come back, I want to talk about another misadventure, the last plane out of Cambodia, which is also a very compelling story. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with Captain Neil Graham Hansen, who flew for Air America. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're speaking with Captain Neil Graham Hansen. You can read his story in the book called Flight, an Air America Pilot's Story of Adventure, Descent, and Redemption. Neil, one of the other things I found just made me shake my head. I mean, this your book reads, and you know, folks have seen the movie Air America. There's some interesting missions that were flown, and one of the ones that really kind of made me shake my head as you were sent to pick up a young lady and transfer her and get her out of Vietnam. And it turns out, you know, it's never easy. Like you said, you got mountains, you got weather, you got danger. You're landing at night on dirt strips with nothing but smudge pots. But it turns out, what was the reason that you had to smuggle this young lady out of Vietnam?
he'd been adopted by Ironside. What the heck's his name, that actor?
Raymond Burr.
He'd been adopted and was going to the United States, and he was the sponsor to that thing. It was a nasty rainy night, and landed at a strip to drop off one of the agents, and from there back into Saigon, taking off nothing but the lights from the Jeep on a dirt strip.
So the CIA was paying to fly a adoptee out of Vietnam for Raymond Burr. Am I getting that right?
Yes, they were.
Oh, boy.
Well, I don't know about the airline, whether they were paying for that, but he'd adopted her, and I was the only form of transportation in the trunk back to Saigon that day, and she had an escort with her, a Vietnamese escort.
Things, obviously, the wheels came off in Vietnam. We had that one helicopter liftoff from the embassy roof. You were flying for another group out of Cambodia. If people aren't familiar with that, just terrible, terrible story that Khmer Rouge took over and just was sweeping across the country. You're caught up in the middle of that as well. Tell us about that day when you're sitting in the aircraft and all of a sudden you look around and there weren't very many people left at the airport.
That's right. The day before, I'd been in Battambang over by the Thai border with a load on my Convair 440. And a friend of mine was there on the raft, too. And a Cambodian officer came up to us, and we could hear a 50 caliber firing outbound. Well, that's keeping the enemy pretty damn close. And he said, "You know, all American go home." And I said, "Well, we're still here." He said, "Yes, they come in. Take your embassy, our generals, our leaders, our politicians, and get in helicopters and leave." And, wow. And I told my friend that next day I'm going to be going to Bangkok, and you be there before 12 o'clock and you can come along. But he said, "I want to go back to Phnom Penh and get my wife." Well, the next day it was kind of scary. A Chinese crew was there, and I told one co-pilot, and I knew Chinese co-pilot, "And how about you come with me tomorrow, or today? I'm going to go to Bangkok." And his captain over, and he said, "Oh, no, you long-nosed round eye in trouble. We Chinese, we no trouble." Mm-hmm. I said, "Okay." And they went out the airport and left for Phnom Penh. And I went back out the airport and fussed around and told my crew, Cambodian steward and stewardess, and stewardess was 14, that we're going to go to Bangkok. How about you go and get your things out of the hotel you're staying at? It's getting real scary. It's getting quiet. And then the DC-3 that the crew had breakfast with came screaming in. Slammed it on the ground and spun around, and the Chinese captain, who thought that he was invincible, jumped out and said, we go, Phnom Penh burning, Phnom Penh burning." And, shut up and go. And they did. And I told them, "Go to a military base so you didn't get impounded." And my steward and stewards came back at about 11:30, 11:45. And 17th. And the station manager, Cambodian, he knew something was up. And I didn't offload the cargo and passengers. I told him we're going to go to Bangkok. And I said, "You come too." And he looked down at his shoes. He said, "No, Captain, my wife's in Phnom Penh." And okay, you can't argue with that. If I would have known what was their future, I might have forced him on the airplane. But I didn't. And it was now 12 o'clock. Steward and stewardess came back, and the ramp was empty. No more noodle stands or pedicabs or anything. Kid real scary. And still no friend on the rise. Well, I told him no, and got on board and folded up the air stair door and the side of the Condor 440 and slid out the cockpit window. Station manager was still standing out there in the ramp with a firebomb, started the right engine, and with temperatures and pressures come up, started the left, and he was still standing there with the fire bottle. I think this must have been something he saw in a movie somewhere, but he always would snap a salute. And on it did, and there were tear tracks on his dusty face. His world was coming to an end. His job, future of his family, there was nothing good on the horizon for him. Pulled out on the runway and, you know, no point in running it up. I'm going to go. And poured the coal to her and coming by the ramp, 90 knots. Looked over and he was still standing there. Rotation and came off Cambodian soil for the last time.
It wasn't until you arrived in Bangkok and were talking to some other folks that you found out that you quite likely were the very last plane out of Cambodia, Neil.
That's right. Well, I knew that when I got came on emergency frequency to relay a flight plan because I didn't know what the frequency was for the Thai center. And Lufthansa 693 came on the air, and then I rattled off a flight plan. And at the end of that, he paused and he said, "Cambodian airspace is closed. Cambodia is no more."
Neil, I appreciate you sharing your story with us. I can tell after all these years, it's still very, very hard. And I tell you, my friend John Essinger, who flew for someone over there, I still don't know who. My suspicion is maybe Air America or someone like that. But I know he about 2 years before he passed, he started to get a lot of PTSD issues. And I think, you know, a lot of us, we think about the folks that serve the military, but we don't think about people like yourself and your Air America comrades who also saw a lot of terrible things and had a lot of near misses. And Neil, are you still in touch with some of those guys? Or
yes, there's hardly any of us left. I'll be 87 here this month, and most everybody's fallen prey to old age.
Do you still? I mean, just hearing your voice, Neil, I assume you still think about a lot of those people, and there's maybe some second thoughts.
Not second thought. I thought we did a good job, and I think we were let down by the powers that be. It was really a shame to abandon everything we'd done, all the people that died. That to me was a cowardly thing to do.
Did any of the other civilians, I'll say, that you met there in the east and in Laos or Bangkok, do you know, did any of them get out and get in touch with you?
Yes, a few.
Okay.
A few, but old age is pretty much taking them out of the playing field. It's age is the biggest enemy we have.
Well, I tell you what, Captain Neil Graham Hansen, it's been a real pleasure and an honor speaking with you, and I'm just going to leave you with this from my old friend John Essinger, and his favorite phrase was, "Happy contrails, sir."
Thank you.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. Just what a powerful interview. Please share these stories. More people need to hear these stories. You can follow us on X, Facebook, Instagram. Be part of our team and share these stories because folks really, really need to hear what you just heard as well. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, this has been Ben Bueller Garcia. All policies and procedures will remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. Archived episodes may be found at AmericanWarriorRadio.com or your favorite podcast platform.